This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
This police drama contains adult language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Previously on NYPD Blue.
Where was God when my boy got killed in that bar?
He was there.
Then he can kiss my ass.
The next time I see you, you're sober and ready to work or you're through.
Do you want people to help you, Andy?
Yeah.
NYPD Blue ended its season last week, an eventful end for Detective Sipowicz. In the next to the last episode, his son Andy Jr. was murdered, and Sipowicz started drinking again. Last week, he sobered up. Before we meet the co-creator of the series, let's go back to the season opener. In the opening scene, a man is sitting in the police precinct in his boxer shorts. His wallet, pants, and car have been stolen at gunpoint. Detective Bobby Simone, played by Jimmy Smits, has been questioning the victim when Detective Sipowicz, played by Dennis Franz, walks into the room.
I mentioned to Mr. White this pattern we've been working on where the prostitute gets into the car and points the John to some romantic parking lot off of South Street, and then a hardworking pimp shows up and sticks a gun in his face. How we got two detectives on the street right now trying to put a stop to this before somebody gets shot. But he can't help us with that because this case is unrelated. This is a whole separate phenomena here because, there's no prostitute involved, right, Mr. White?
I told you what happened.
Mr. White told me what happened. So he can't be of help on this pattern that we've been working on where we got these two cops out on the street busting their ass. I'm feeling kind of bad now because I thought Mr. White might be lying.
Well, maybe being in a strange police station, he just can't remember right. Maybe needs more familiar surroundings.
Could that be, Mr. White?
Try taking him over to his house and talking it out with his wife in the room and see if maybe that might jog his memory.
Wait. No. I think we should do that.
All right.
My guest is NYPD Blue's co-creator David Milch. He's written much of the dialogue that's made the show so popular. Helping him to keep the series believable is Bill Clark, who's also with us. He's a former New York City homicide detective who worked on such high-profile cases as the Son of Sam and the Zodiac murders. Many of the stories on NYPD Blue are based on his work. He was still on the force when he began consulting. About a year and a half ago, after 25 years on the force, he retired and moved to L.A., where he continues to work on the show. David Milch and Bill Clark have collaborated on the book True Blue, The Real Stories Behind NYPD Blue. A little later in the interview, David Milch will quote some lines he wrote for NYPD Blue that contain language some listeners may find offensive. I asked Detective Clark about interrogating suspects. Often on NYPD Blue, during an interrogation, the cop tries to convince the suspect that he's better off without a lawyer.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that annoys me with television, other than our show, is the fact that people seem to think that the lawyer just comes in to kind of referee the interrogation so that nobody lays a hand on him and he's not intimidated. Well, the reality is, if an attorney enters the room, if he allows the suspect to confess, he is then going to be sued for malpractice. So he is not going to allow him to answer any of your questions. So effectively, the interrogation is shut down the minute that he calls for an attorney. So we work very hard to keep him out of there so that we don't shut down what in most cases is the single biggest piece of evidence against the guy, which is a confession.
Now, on the show, the cops are always trying to make it seem like it's going to be a better deal for the suspect if he talks to the cops before the lawyer comes.
Yeah, that's the biggest lie we ever tell. I mean, it's most times...
You suspects out there, Bill doesn't mean it.
Yeah. Most times when a guy sits into that interview room, if he doesn't confess, then a great deal of time he'll wind up either walking back out a free man or it'll be at trial a big piece of evidence against him if he does. I'll give you an example of something. It's not my favorite subject, but the O.J. Simpson case. I think one of the mistakes that was made in that case was there was so much evidence against O.J. Simpson, physical evidence. I've never seen so much circumstantial evidence in any case, that rather than get the confession, they did a brief 30-minute interview with him and let him go. Now, with all of the so-called inconsistencies and mishandling and anything else that was brought out in trial, if there had been a confession from O.J. Simpson, he would have been convicted. There was no way that the jury could have looked past that. And that's the lesson that a detective learns very early in his career is, with a confession, it's easier for you on the stand because they're not going to beat you up as hard because they know there's a confession that they've got to deal with. And to me, that's the single biggest thing I've always worked for.
So what are some of the things that a cop might tell a suspect to get the suspect to not make that phone call to the lawyer?
Well, one of the things is you tell a guy, listen, you know, you're the guy that's going to do the time, not the attorney. He's looking to come in here for money. He doesn't care about your welfare. You know, this is the time to make the deal. It's going to help you. You can explain why you did it, the motives behind it. You know you didn't mean this. It was an accident type thing. And, you know, something had to drive you to commit this act. I had a case very similar to the Simpson case a week or two before that. And a man and woman stabbed brutally. The woman was stabbed about 30 times, the man about 60. Trail of blood leaving the scene. I had the guy in about 3 days later, excuse me, and I told him, I says, listen, you know, this is a vicious crime here. This is horrible. I says, something had to push you over the edge to do this. You don't want to go in as a crazy man, or just a vicious murderer. Something had to do it. And he explained it away that it was a jealousy thing, and he lost control. He had done a few years in jail, and he realized when he cut the first guy, that he had blew it and he was going to go back, and he just lost control and he just stabbed out of frustration. So
it's important to realize that it's so easy to simplify or oversimplify what a detective does during the course of an interrogation as one thing or another thing. There's an element of physical intimidation sometimes, but much more often you have to be sympathetic to the guy. You have to let him know that you understand what moved him and put him in that position. And when someone is willing to cross the line the way a murderer has been by the act of committing the murder, you have to realize that the court of justice is not necessarily the thing that he or she is looking for in the course of the interrogation. They want to feel understood. They want to feel supported. There's a whole range of motivations that the detective can look to satisfy and subordinate the suspect's impulse to get someone else in there. If the person feels that the detective is his best ally, or the detective understands him, in the case Billy's talking about, when he got, that's the Flowers case, when
right.
he got the confession from Flowers. Afterwards, Flowers said he was the nicest guy Bill had ever met. This poor guy wound up dying a few days later of an asthma attack. But he felt that Billy was his best friend at the end of that interview.
Bill, would you ever make promises to suspects that you couldn't really keep in order to help get a confession?
Well, legally, you can't make promises that you can't keep. You can lie to him about things, but, you know, as far as time served and stuff like, you know, time that he would do in jail and stuff like that, you can't do. But as far as evidence that I have against him, that I have co-defendants that have flipped and stuff like that, I've lied many, many times.
That's legal. You have to understand that the legal test is you may mislead a suspect so long as the way you mislead him would not make an innocent man confess. In other words, you can't say, I have your wife in the next room, and unless you confess, I'm going to beat her, because then an innocent man might confess. But you are able to say your running mates have confessed. You are able to say, you know, we've got evidence from the scene. We recovered the gun. Because an innocent man would know that that wasn't true.
You know, this subject comes up in the book that you co-wrote together, True Blue, about NYPD Blue and the stories behind it. David, you had asked Detective Bill Clark if he actually ever, you know, roughed anybody up to get a confession.
And, yes.
And, Bill, you give a description not of roughing somebody up, but of making the motions just to kind of inspire a certain amount of fear, I guess, in the suspect. You say, you know, you locked the door, took your watch off, and put your ring on the table and said, now we're going to talk about what I'm here for. You took this man's life, and you have to understand if what it takes to make you give that up is laying hands on you, I'm going to beat you till you beg to die. Now, would you follow up on that, or is that just a threat to let the person know you're serious?
No, I would think, fortunately, most people growing up in this country have seen so many movies where cops and detectives beat a guy senseless that they, if you just make them think that we're going to get to that point somewhere along the line, it has the same effect as if you beat the head up against the wall for 2 hours. And I'm not some kind of guy that gets any pleasure out of hitting you people, so I that's not my act. But if they feel that if it goes down to the wire, that's one of the options, it's something they think about. I don't think about it that much. I'm playing a game with this guy. I mean, I've done interrogations for 12 hours before a guy confessed.
12 hours in one sitting?
One sitting, one person. I just come in and out of the room. One that I remember was a triple homicide. Guy was in for a rape that if I didn't get a confession, he was going to go in for that rape, and those three homicides never would have been solved. And I really wasn't sure he did it up until about the 11th hour.
Bill, how did you keep your concentration during a 12-hour interrogation?
Well, I mean, there were times I'd step out of the room and I'd just clear my head. I mean, it is very, very tiring and at times. And the thing that you're terrified of, and I've had it happen, where you've got a guy and you spend 4 or 5 hours and then you ask some stupid question that you know set it back to ground zero again. You know, you have to be very careful what you say. And
like what? What could be a setback like that?
If you're looking to get a guy to flip on his co-defendants and you say something about being a rat or something that, I mean, I'm using real bad examples, but I think you get the idea.
It gives
the
wrong emotional connotation to Bill's position.
So something that's going to insult the suspect.
Yeah, what he's looking to make the guy feel that he's sympathetic towards him. The other thing that Billy will do, and it's something that we haven't been able to do particularly successfully on the show because of the time element, is that when Billy goes at a guy, sometimes he'll have only one piece. He'll have a license plate, or he'll have the driver's license, or so, and he may not use it for 6 hours. He'll go at the guy with irrelevancies to exhaust him or to build up a particular state of emotional receptivity. And then finally, when he uses the piece of evidence he's got, it invokes a whole range of knowledge that Bill has in the guy's mind that Billy doesn't have. And so it's a very delicate emotional framework that he's trying to generate there. And that's one reason why Billy likes to work by himself.
David, there's a scene that you wrote for Andy Sipowicz, the Dennis Franz character. He's questioning a person who he believes is a suspect in a murder. It was a white victim, and the suspect is African-American.
Right.
And the African-American man challenges Sipowicz and says, you just think I'm a suspect because I'm black. I'm black and she was white, so you think I was involved with this. And then Sipowicz starts questioning him. I want you to, if you can remember, repeat some of the lines that Sipowicz uses there.
Well, what he says is, Mr. Futrell, have I been disrespectful to you? And the guy says, my having to be here is disrespectful, because this guy's a PhD candidate at Hunter or something. And the girl had dated this guy, the white girl, who was the only surviving member of the family, had dated this black fellow who's a PhD candidate. So Sipowicz is questioning the guy. Sipowicz says, our suspect profile, you fit the profile. The girl says, sometimes you're rough. I'm wondering whether you told any of your buddies about having been in this apartment. And the guy says, in other words, I may not be a criminal nigger, but you get enough niggers together, some of them have to be criminals. So what I do is I go to my buddies and I say, I'm b***ing this rich white girl, and here's the layout of her apartment. Is that the way you got it figured, detective? And Sipowicz sort of goes at that point, and he says, look, we're investigating a murder. It so happens the assholes that did this murder were black. Now, how do you want me to go with this? You want me to say, I'm sorry for the injustice you people have suffered for the past 400 years, but did you talk to any of your friends about the homicide? Should we do it that way? And the guy says, yeah, let's do it that way. So Sipowicz says, okay, well, I know that great African-American George Washington Carver discovered the peanut, but did you tell your friends about the layout of this apartment? So now, it's quite clear. The guy says, well, you're a racist scumbag. And Sipowicz says, ouch. By which he means, you know, tell me something I don't already know.
My guests are David Milch, the co-creator of NYPD Blue, and creative consultant Bill Clark, a retired New York City homicide detective. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with NYPD Blue co-creator David Milch and retired detective Bill Clark, they collaborated on the new book, True Blue, The Real Stories Behind NYPD Blue. On NYPD Blue, there's been a lot of relationships within the force. You know, cops dating other cops.
Yes, uh-huh.
And now, of course, Andy Sipowicz is married to the assistant DA, which is related. Bill, how much of this actually went on the force in New York when you were there?
Well, you asked the wrong guy, because I'm just recently got engaged to a girl who was my partner about 10 years ago. But I mean, it's something that was said before that I guess I didn't go into in enough detail. We spend 8 hours, 10 hours, sometimes 36 hours with your partner working in a very intense job with dealing with all types of emotions. People who have just sustained the greatest loss of their life. They've lost their husband, their wife, their mother, their father, their sister, their brother, the breadwinner of the family. I mean, all of the things that happen to somebody when a homicide happens. And you're dealing with all of those emotions, and this is the person who tries, when you get alone, when you're in the car going from point A to point B, this is the person that you talk to, and hopefully you try to make some kind of semblance of sanity out of the whole thing and feel good enough that you can go on to the next step. And it's bound to make you very, very close with that person. And if that person happens to be a female, it's is a together person who makes you it's just going to draw you closer together. Or if it's just the opposite, if you can't stand this person, it's going to drive you apart. So, again, in my experience, I've worked with several females, but as I said, one who was my partner, I've just recently got engaged to. So.
Were you romantically involved while you were partners?
No, but there was a certain attraction, there was no doubt about it, but... at that point, no, it wouldn't have been the right thing.
Is that a dangerous thing on the job when you feel that emotionally involved with somebody? You know, when that spark is there, even if you haven't acted on it, because your lives are both constantly in jeopardy.
No, but I can remember we're doing that in one of our episodes this year. You do get overly protective. I mean, this is you do cop stuff every day, and a guy goes in or a girl goes in to buy drugs or to make purchase of guns or stolen property, and naturally, if you're really have heavy emotional feelings about the person, or in fact in love with it does become the terror can take charge there for a few minutes. It happened to me one time. I know
what happened.
This girl who I had these feelings for was going in to purchase some stolen property, and it was a real nothing thing. It was we had six detectives on the scene, and she was supposed to give a signal when she had made a thing, and it was supposed to be done in front of the house, and she went into the house, and then all of a sudden I started getting anxiety, like what, something must be going wrong. And it was just strictly a question of me overreacting because I had feelings for the girl.
So what'd you do? I mean, did you go in and
no, I didn't.
You just sat there and were nervous, or did you...
The last time I experienced that, I was in Vietnam, and it was at night, it was pitch dark, and I was in an ambush patrol, and I started hearing things, and you get to control your fear, and that's basically what it was. It was just my controlling my fear, but a fear that shouldn't have even been there.
Bill, you retired from the New York City Police as from your job as a detective during the second season of NYPD Blue. While you were still working as a detective and consulting with the series, was there a new degree of, well, almost self-consciousness that entered your work? Would you be reporting on a case and in the back of your mind see it as an episode?
No, I mean, I did my job as I saw it. I never really thought if a case went down while I was doing it that this would be a good episode. No,
Billy is not someone who is comfortable with that kind of irony or distance when he's working as a detective. He takes that very, very seriously. And I know from speaking with him about cases that he was working on all during the period when he was still an active detective, that but you know, if you're a good detective, so much of that coincides with being a good storyteller, because what you're trying to do is sort of extrapolate a whole world or a whole personality from pieces of information. And so when Billy would talk about the cases he was working on, he didn't really need to rephrase for my purposes, because just Billy being Billy, and the way I think I say in the book, you know, when Billy would work on cases, you'd watch him get sick over the cases. They would just occupy his whole being, and when a case wasn't going well, he would be miserable, and you couldn't talk to him, and so he was like the most beautiful sort of prism for both the case and for a cop reacting to the case.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
David Milch is the co-creator of NYPD Blue. Bill Clark is a retired New York City homicide detective who is a consultant to the series. They collaborated on the book True Blue, The Real Stories Behind NYPD Blue. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.